welcome to the show, my friends. Greg Kokel here, your host, and the show is called Stand to Reason, because that's what we do. Well, I'm actually sitting at the moment, but what we do is metaphorically stand up, which amounts to in the line of fire much of the time, to reason for classical Christianity and for classical Christian values. Tomorrow I get on a plane and fly to Minneapolis because we've got our big event there, our reality event, and I've just this is my final word to you. We've got 1391 signed up. That means there's 109 slots left, which is very little. We are almost sold out. If you haven't registered yet and you're thinking about doing it, and you're thinking you might go and register at the door, don't count on it. It's possible somebody may be able to get in, but maybe not your whole crowd. We are limited by law to 1,500, and we're pushing 1,500 right now. So go to realityapologetics.com. I think that's the website, and sign up for an event. Everybody's gearing up. We're getting on planes in the next 2 days. We got everything going. We're so excited about the big conference Friday night and all day Saturday. So that's on its way. And by the way, if you're in some other climb, you're not within striking distance, you can actually sign up for SDR's Reality Apologetics Student Conference streaming live from Minneapolis. That is a very new thing for us. Actually, we did it just a little bit when we were in Seattle 2 weeks ago. But this is, or maybe it was 4 weeks ago, I guess. But in any event, this is a big enterprise for us. All the information is there on the website, realityapologetics.com. Is that it? Realityapologetics.com. See, I don't have my regular information here, so I think that's it. Let me just double check, see what I got. Maybe email will tell me. But SDR Reality Apologetics, you should be able to find it. And you can sign up for the streaming version. And right now we've got, what do we got? We've got 20 different signups, but a whole bunch of half of them are groups of people. So there are whole youth groups that are in different places that have signed up for the event, and we're thrilled for those that are streaming in. So that's coming up this weekend. Now, I am. I want to open up with a response to a challenge that has been offered, and I have a buddy who is capable in helping me out, but he took a break to get some water, shall we say? And I'm not sure if he's back yet. Are you there, Tim?
I'm here. I'm ready for you. And I just wanted to let everybody know it's realityapologetics.com. So no,
thank you.
You don't have to put STR on there. Realityapologetics.com will get them to the right
place. All right, dynamite. Okay, super. I'm glad you're on board. Of course, Tim Barnett, the infamous Tim Barnett of RPL Red Pen Logic fame. And I know that right after our segment, because you're going to be on for a segment or two or whatever for a little bit here this first hour as we kind of work through an issue.
Yeah.
Right after that, you're doing an RPL right there from home, right there. You're doing your basic your production work for your thing. Then it goes to post-production, and we'll get that thing out. But are you like having fun with this?
Oh, I have a ball doing this. I mean, you know, Greg, and people need to know that this is not just a one-man effort, okay? There's a team of people behind these things. Mm-hmm. And almost on a daily basis, I'm sending you possible tweets that we could, you know, it has to go through the checks and balances. Okay, is this the right issue? Mm-hmm. And then once we pick the right tweet to respond to, there's a whole host of things that we go over. And mm-hmm. So there are times where I spend my Friday night. It's just me and Greg on a date, sometimes 2 hours just walking through a script, you know. And so we take this thing pretty seriously. Yeah. And we have a lot of fun doing it. And I have to record these things. It's just after 7 here. Mm-hmm. My kids will be in bed in about an hour. And mm-hmm. that's when I can sit down at my computer when it's mm-hmm. quiet. And record.
Yeah, well, that Aboot was a giveaway that he's in Canada where he lives in Ontario, East Coast time, so it's much later for him. I think he was supposed to be washing dishes after dinner right now or something like that, but yeah. I was able to rescue him from that responsibility. And we talked together, Tim, and incidentally, this is just for transparency's sake, I mean, this is the kind of thing that we do. Tim and I and John and Alan and Amy and some of the other team occasionally, you know, we knock things around. And when we come upon something that we want to assess, we sometimes get help. And we just benefit iron sharpening iron. And this is one of those things. An article that was written that came across a couple of days ago, and it's titled Christianity's Immovable Rock versus Its Irresistible Force. So there are Christianity is up against something tough, and Christianity is tough, and you know which is going to give is kind of the implication of the title. Although Tim, maybe you can make clear the title for us in a little bit, because it's not clear to me what the immovable rock is and what the irresistible force is as the article develops. But it broadly has to do with the whole relationship of science versus faith, and whether Christians are making a mistake in trying to make their case from the so-called facts of science as evidence to support their religious views. And this is a critique of that view, which critique, by the way, comes not just from outsiders like this one, Bob Seidensticker, if I pronounced his name properly, but also from inside. And this is one of the things he trades on. Even Christians think that this is a mistake. And then he develops his article. Now, my name is in this article, and so is Stand to Reasons and some other Christians, which means he's taking exception with my view. Now, I just will tell you quite frankly, I don't like to be criticized in public. Who does, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so my tendency initially is I get bugged inside and then I don't want to look at it. I mean, it's just a human reaction. So I'm just kind of, Tim, letting everybody know that I'm human like everybody else. But I have recommended a way of dealing with these kinds of things in the past. And I think just recently I said I've written something, Tim, where you just kind of you see something that maybe shakes you up or bothers you, like a headline or an apparent challenge that you read about. I think just a recent mentoring letter was similar to this. Well, what do you do? Well, sometimes the challenges come in a kind of barrage, like boom, 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 boom. And it's hard to know what to do with all of that, and it feels a little overwhelming. So what I suggested, Tim, in this piece is that, first of all, take a deep breath. Okay, don't get defensive, Greg. Don't get upset. Don't get overwhelmed. How do you not get overwhelmed? Well, you take it piece by piece. So you relax a little bit, and I'm speaking to myself here. This is how I do it. I relax. I sum up and break down. In other words, I don't break down, but I sum up and break down the arguments. What actually is being said here? And this, by the way, is a step that you and I do this all the time, Tim, when we are addressing issues. But it's such a vital part of doing assessment that I think a lot of Christians don't think of. That is, there's a mechanics to this process that allows us to solve the problem. And when we put the mechanics into play, it makes the job easier. And the mechanics are simply, after you relax, take a deep breath, you try to isolate the particular points that are being made. And sometimes that's not easy, is it, Tim? Because these challenges that we get on the internet or wherever in articles are sometimes a little bit hard to figure out. I mean, that they're woven in with rhetoric and language and stuff, so it's not even easy to figure out what the person is getting at. Like this title, Christianity's Immovable Rock versus Its Irresistible Force. I'll get into the content in a minute, but Tim, how would you characterize what this author thinks those competing factors are?
You know what, Greg, it's not entirely clear. You know, at Stand to Reason, we kind of pride ourselves on being really clear in how we communicate. Mm-hmm. And I guess he was going for a flashy title here. Mm-hmm. The idea is, I'm guessing there's two competing, Christianity has two competing ideas.
Right.
And one is, and you're going to get into this, but you have, on the one hand, there's these Christians, okay, that think evidence matters. Mm-hmm. In particular, scientific evidence matters. And then on the other hand, he's got these other Christians, and for them, well, actually, science doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like, he's pointing out here that there are these two groups, and it's almost like there's a conflict.
Sure.
I'm not entirely sure what his point is, and there's a few straw men, and we can talk about that as we go.
Right.
You know, he finishes with this kind of line, sometimes Christians do my work for me. Like he's made some point. And I mean, as we go along here, we're going to see that actually he's created this kind of false dichotomy, and there's some things we can agree with him as we go. But there's other things that he misses the mark by a mile.
Yeah, there is nothing in this article that is in the least wise inimical to making the case for Christianity, okay? And I think that the immovable rock and the irresistible force are, some people say it does matter, apologetics, based on evidence, and others say it doesn't matter. And the people who say it doesn't matter, there's actually two different groups he identifies, and that is one group that says it doesn't matter because there's a danger in building your case on the shifting sands of science.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other group says it doesn't matter because science doesn't matter. All that matters is what the Bible says.
Yeah.
Now, this is characteristic of more the young earth crowd, and I think their approach creates problems for themselves that are addressed in this piece that don't apply to us. So I'm just setting that crowd aside for the moment. That is, I'm not going to answer the challenges, and we're not going to speak to the challenges offered to their group, since that's not our view. Our view is, as he points out, and this is the first point that he gets to, I mean, he does show this dichotomy between these two conflicting schools of thought. It just strikes me as a little bit odd to refer to them as the immovable rock versus the irresistible force. I mean, that would be like God's sovereignty and human freedom might be characterized that way. Mm-hmm. But this? Anyway, all right, so he's being clever with the title. I'm not going to fault him for that, but it was confusing for me at first. So there are these two schools of thoughts, and so his first point is, we claim that science supports Christianity. And I think what I'll do here, Tim, is I'll just kind of give a little bit of an overview of the argument for folks who don't have the article, which is titled, as I just described, if they want to find it, shouldn't be difficult, Christianity's Immovable Rock versus Its Irresistible Force. And actually, he makes it easy, at least with the first two points, because he's got these as headings. So remember I said break down the argument so that the issues are clear. All right, what is being claimed here? That's the second step. First step, take a deep breath and relax. Next, get clear on what's being said and break it into its individual points. And the third step is assess the individual points. You see, that little game plan, which I think, Tim, I just wrote about. Didn't I just write about this in a mentoring letter? I was talking about that football player, Rodgers, that quarterback who laid out this whole stream of objections to Christianity. Anyway, I think it just came up.
It might be out, or it might that might be coming out.
It's hard to remember because you have to write these things in advance. In any event, but that is basically the breakdown. And it's a very simple little way of approaching things so that you don't get overwhelmed. Okay, so here's his first point. We claim that science supports Christianity. Okay, and I won't get into all the particulars, but just we do. And there are organizations like Discovery Institute, Stand to Reason, Reasons to Believe, Cold Case Christianity, Reasonable Faith, Bill Craig, etc., that enthusiastically point to science to support their Christian position. But then he goes on to say, science makes a poor foundation for faith. Because if you're putting – I'm trying to characterize the way he puts it. Some of our listeners are going to see right away there's a problem here. But if we're putting our faith in science, and science is a shifting discipline in terms of its information, particular scientific theories end up giving way to other scientific theories. And if we base our faith on that, well, then we lose our grounds. Okay, and then this raises another question, and this is an implicit point for him, is that Christian apologists never acknowledge that that weakens their case. They say their case is built on evidence, and when the evidence goes against them, they don't say, okay, well then my faith is illicit. So you don't really care, and this is the fourth point, therefore your faith really isn't in the evidence because the evidence doesn't matter except when it seems to go your way. And there's a special pleading challenge that is offered there. But when it goes against you, you just move on and you don't acknowledge it. Okay. So does that sound to you like a kind of captured the basic points of his argument?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. And the point that science is shifting sand and it's dangerous for us to ground our faith in science is a point that Christians make as well, okay? Not those that say it doesn't matter because science doesn't matter, it only matters what God's word says. That's a different crowd. But there is a crowd that is going to say this creates a liability. Don't hitch your wagon to the current theories of science. Now, you have offered three different things that are criticisms, your critique when you responded, and we talked about this, Tim, and we both have found different things wrong with it in a certain way. Some overlap here, but let me just start by making a statement, and then I want to hear from you from your side on this, on why I think that that a careful apologists do not depend on science the way it is depicted here. And if that's true, then this is really a false representation of what we do. Certainly, Frank Turek and J.P. Moreland, when Moreland wasn't in there, and me and Craig Turek and Bill Craig, and Jay Warner, etc. We do our defense of Christianity in a different fashion, okay? So what we are not doing is we are not looking at the fresh trends in science and hitching our wagon to the current ideas of scientists. I think that's a mistaken way of characterizing it. What we are trying to do is trying to look at the well-established empirical data about the nature of the world. Mm-hmm. And then ask the question, which worldview best explains the data? Does a naturalistic, materialistic worldview explain this data that is not in contention? Or does a theistic worldview do a better job of explaining the data? Now, J. Warner Wallace is very clear to point out that this is a very particular type of reasoning. This is abductive. It's reasoning from the evidence to the best explanation of the evidence. It's what he did as a detective, okay? And so, and this is what I see us doing. You know, we're not we could look at, is it a big bang? Is it a singularity? Is it young? Is it old? All of those things that people differ on, and scientists and different folks have different ideas about how to explain. But the notion that the universe had a primitive beginning is not on the table. Mm-hmm. Because the evidence is so overwhelming for the fact of the beginning, not just empirically, and I'm making a distinction between the empirical evidence and the scientist's explanation of the empirical evidence. That's their theories, okay? The empirical evidence and there are metaphysical elements to this as well. There are philosophical elements that point to the origin of the universe. So my clarification as this point is just to say that the way that people mentioned in the article characteristically use quote-unquote science is to draw on the well-justified empirical data, not all of the, you know, necessarily the current favorite characterization of what that data means and how it ought to be characterized. And then we ask the question, what's the best explanation? By the way, there's no other way to go about it. There just is no other way to go about it. You have to look at whatever evidence you think is well justified and then draw your conclusions from that. Anyway, so that's my opening salvo. It seems to be a little misunderstanding of the way I think careful apologists use the data. They're not hitching their wagon to science, but they are trying to see what empirical details are well justified and ask which worldview best explains them.
Yeah. And Greg, there's another point there, just that, we're not, as you said, we're not just chasing after the latest scientific, theory or article that just came out. These are things, what we're doing is we're looking at, here's a theory like the Big Bang cosmology, that typically what the atheist who holds to science believes. And so we're just saying, look at, you hold this view. Well, we're coming along here and saying, here's the best explanation for this particular effect. Okay. And so it's kind of a strategic point. It's not necessarily that we have to lead with it. Mm-hmm. But when you sent me this email, saying, here's this article, what do you guys think? I just, this morning started typing up some things. And the first thing, I think this article is just, it misses the mark on a number of things. The first thing I said was it fails because it doesn't take into account our cumulative case. And I think when we were talking before, you made a similar observation. It's almost like the author of this article only is taking into account one kind of evidence, and that's scientific evidence.
That's right. Yeah, that's actually his second point. Science is a poor foundation for faith. Notice he identifies science as the foundation for faith. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's – but we're not arguing that science is the foundation of our faith, okay? Mm-hmm. No Christian is making that claim. Now, scientific evidence is one piece of evidence that we can point to. Mm-hmm. But there are lots of other pieces, if you were to read someone like Jay Warner, and it seems like this person is familiar with Jay Warner Wallace's work, in God's Crime Scene, he lays out, there's some scientific arguments that he gives for God, but he also appeals to many other arguments, mm-hmm. philosophical, moral, historical, this kind of thing.
Correct.
And so, I in the email replied to you, I said that you could take away the scientific evidence and you would still have a strong case for Christianity. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, I said the Big Bang, oftentimes we'll point to the Big Bang and we'll say, see, a Big Bang needs a big banger. And this points to God, right? This is a good argument for God. But that's not the foundation of my faith. And that's what Bob, or the author here, seems to assume that, so if the Big Bang theory were shown tomorrow to be false, and maybe some kind of steady state eternal theory, mm-hmm. they come out with, well, then all you Christians—
Which is pretty much the only other alternative.
Yeah, something to that
either
effect.
Temporal or eternal,
Yeah. This misses the mark. Christians don't base their faith on X theory, okay, whatever that is, mm-hmm. Big Bang or some kind of ID theory. No, our faith is based on the resurrection, is what I said. And I think William Lane Craig is really helpful on this, because he says our worldview, our case for Christianity looks more like chainmail than it looks like a linear chain.
Right.
And so if your faith is just like a linear chain, and one of the links in your chain is the Big Bang theory, or is irreducible complexity, like you're basing your faith on a mousetrap idea, mm-hmm. The bacterial flagellum or something. Yeah. And then someone comes along and refutes that, or science changes for whatever reason. Yeah. Your faith is destroyed. Mm-hmm. But if it's like chainmail, where you have all these links and they're all joined in different areas, then when you get one link in the chain that's broken, the armor isn't destroyed. You still have it all connected. And I think that this, so he's assuming that's what our faith is like.
Sure. And what the chainmail is meant to describe, you're using it in armor, but really epistemologically, it's talking about patterns of justification. And so we have all of these interlocking patterns of justification, reasons why we think that Christianity, that is the theistic, Christian theistic worldview, is the best explanation for the way things are. It has the most explanatory power, which incidentally is a very scientific methodology. Mm-hmm. You look at effects and you look at the circumstances and you ask what, given the circumstances, is the best explanation for the effects. Now, if it turns out, as some Christians have said, that this is not a good idea to hitch our wagon to something that there are changing opinions on, well, that means we cannot hitch our evidential wagon to anything. Because not only are there changing opinions in science, there are changing opinions in history. There are changing opinions in biology. Well, that's science, but opinions in textual criticism and in theology and all kinds of every discipline that might be drawn on, even philosophy, that might be drawn on as a source of evidence, in principle, could be compromised. All that means is that our view is falsifiable. That's all it means. And just because we have a chink in the armor, to go back to your metaphor, Bill Craig's metaphor, doesn't mean the armor doesn't hold together. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, if it turned out that every single link in the chain mail was destroyed, well, then we would be unjustified in believing in Christianity if we said that our belief in Christianity depends upon the evidence, and it turns out there is no evidence, and we still believe that then I think the criticism would be well-grounded. But that isn't the kind of circumstance that we're facing here. And I mentioned something else too, Tim, I think I did a moment ago, that some of these things have metaphysical elements to them, okay? So that if there is a primitive beginning to everything, then a cause and effect principle comes into play, and you can't deny the cause and effect principle based on science because science depends on the cause and effect principle to work, first of all, and the principle itself is not part of science. It's a metaphysical notion that is used in science in order to draw conclusions about cause and effect in the natural realm, okay? Now, there's no reason we can't use the nature of the natural realm to infer a cause outside of the natural realm if it turns out that the natural realm is an effect. And notice that kind of argument does not depend on science. It depends on a metaphysical notion that science itself depends on in order to operate.
Yeah. So I'm with you, Greg. I think that once you understand that there's a cumulative case here, and it's not just, not all things are equal. Not all evidence is equal here,
right.
And it doesn't all rest on one piece of evidence. That completely undermines, I think, his entire article.
Right.
I mean, there's more that we're going to say here, but that's a huge point.
Yeah. Let me give you another example. If let's just say you're an archaeologist and you think that or paleontologist, whatever, you think that this particular area was inhabited by ancient hominids and you're looking around for evidence of tools. So you have an idea, right? And you are staking your reputation for whatever reason that ancient hominids lived right in this area. And then you find a chipped piece of flint. And you mistakenly assume that it's an artifact. In other words, that this was made for a purpose and didn't happen naturally. And then later on down the line, after closer examination, your evidence turns out to be bad. Further scientific analysis, the judgment of the people there looking at it said, you know what? We've got lots of things that are like this that we know are knocked around in a river or whatever, and this is the way they look. This is not an artifact. Well, the fact that one piece of evidence that is empirical turns out not to be evidence for agency, that is an agent making something, doesn't mean there can't be any other arrowheads laying around. All it means is that piece of evidence turns out not to be a piece of evidence. It does not disqualify the larger idea. And I will say with confidence that there is nothing that we have learned about science. There are philosophies of science that have concluded this, but nothing regarding the empirical data that scientists have produced that forecloses on the existence of God. In fact, it's not possible for it to do that because science cannot foreclose on the existence of anything that's not physical. It can assume it, but that's philosophy. That's not science. And that's mostly what's going on. So here's another reason why science can be useful as evidence for an agent in the universe. But like you said, it's not the only evidence. And just because some evidence might turn out to be inconclusive or explained better in a different way, which is fine. Nobody thinks nowadays that Thor makes thunder. That doesn't change the broad equation at all. It just tells you that Thor doesn't make thunder. That's all it tells you.
Yeah.
It actually doesn't even tell you anything about the existence of Thor, for goodness sake. Now, I have no reason to believe that Thor exists. But just because one aspect can be falsified does not mean that undermines the entire theistic enterprise. And that's it seems the way he goes with this article.
Okay, so here's the second thing, and this is equally important. It's actually what the whole article, as you're talking, I'm thinking through this. This whole article is about the role of science for Christians. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so he's got two groups of Christians here. You got the one group who says science, that is the grounds of their faith. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is why they're a Christian, science. And then there's this other group who says, no, science is a poor foundation. So we just keep science out of it. We don't care what science says, this kind of idea. And actually you could break that group up a little bit more, but let's not talk about that group. So you got these. So we're asking the question: what role does science play? And here's the thing: this guy misses the mark because it's not either this or that. It's not either it grounds your faith or it's a poor foundation for your faith. It turns out for us, scientific evidence does play a supportive role in our faith. And some scientific evidence plays maybe a bigger role than others. But when it comes to something like, let's just take, we were talking about Big Bang cosmology, right? Mm-hmm. And that seems at the moment to point strongly to a beginning of the universe. Mm-hmm. And a beginning implies a beginner, okay? That's current science. But if the evidence of Big Bang cosmology were reversed, and would that mean that there is no God? And the answer is no. That doesn't follow. Just because you refute Big Bang cosmology doesn't mean there is no God. As you just said, actually, no scientific theory could refute the existence of God.
Right. That was the point I was just making.
It's not the right tool to do the job.
Correct.
And I mean, I was thinking about this. Look, Thomas Aquinas actually had no problem with an eternal universe. And he thought that God was still the creator and sustainer of
his existence. He didn't just think it. He argued.
That's right. That's right. And so I said in my email reply to you, I said pre-scientific people had no trouble believing, and we shouldn't either. Look, our faith is not grounded. That's the word he uses in science. Okay, it does play a supportive role, but going back to our first point, it's just part of our cumulative case. Right. Okay. And so it's not like if you refute this one theory, therefore, you know, we all have to, throw Christianity out or something.
So let's just say, for example, going back to Aquinas, let's just say that scientists gave really powerful evidence that there was no beginning to the universe, that the universe is eternal. Yeah. Now, it's hard to imagine that happening because there are other problems with that, and they're philosophical problems. They're problems that have to do with actual infinites and stuff, and we don't need to get into the details here. But what's curious is if the universe did not have a beginning, well, then the Kalam cosmological argument, as offered by William Lane Craig, is not going to work. Mm-hmm. Because it part of its premise is the universe came into existence. And Bill Craig would be the first person to say if the universe did not come into existence, then the Kalam cosmological argument would no longer apply. However, Leibniz also had a different form of the yeah. cosmological argument that had nothing to do with the universe coming into existence. It was an argument of a different sort. And you mentioned Thomas Aquinas too. And so this is why what we're describing is a web that is very, very tightly woven. Okay, and there is something else that happened in this article. This was the third point that he brought up, and that is when scientific evidence turns against them, they refuse to abandon their faith. Well, wait a minute. First of all, what is the scientific evidence that has turned against them? Yeah. That is evidence against God. That's the first thing, and you mentioned that I know in your response to me, but I think yeah. you just mentioned it a few moments ago. But here's how he puts it. He says, the weakness of this position is that such an apologist is never committed to the argument that he's offering. They might say, well, how do you explain abiogenesis? Or you can't tell me what caused the Big Bang. But those are just ploys. When science reaches a conclusion about any of these questions, the apologist will drop it and pick up the next challenge du jour. Nothing's at stake. They demand that you question your worldview but refuse to reciprocate. Now, that, I think, is a distortion. Notice something that's going on here. First of all, people like me are not saying, well, how do you explain abiogenesis? Or you can't tell me what caused the Big Bang. That is arguing like a person who's asserting a God of the gaps. Our view is there is no gap. There is an explanation for biogenesis, and it isn't a biogenesis. There is life coming from non-life, but it's coming from a creator who takes and makes life happen because chance can't make that happen. So we are not saying you don't know how it happened, so God did it. We are looking at the details of the empirical evidence itself, and we are saying those details have God's finger, have the fingerprints of agency all over them. And by the way, when I'm going through my stuff, I called Doug Axe last night, you know, and we talked a little bit about it. This is his specialty. He's at Discovery Institute. He wrote the book Undeniable. And this is his same point. Okay, we are not God of the gaps here, which is implied by how this paragraph starts. We are saying we have an explanation for the cause of the Big Bang, and your explanation is that nothing caused it. It isn't that they don't have an explanation. It's that nothing caused it. It's the universe from nothing. I mean, that's the famous statement. Okay, and that is counterintuitive. We have an alternative that makes sense. All right, and it's the odds-on favorite. Let's put it that way in a radical understatement. But then he says, when science reaches a conclusion about any of these questions. Wait a minute. This is an assumption that science will answer the question about abiogenesis. But that is a science of the gaps, first of all, an assumption of metaphysical naturalism as being adequate to do the job, even though it hasn't been adequate up till this point. But it is also a denial of the nature of the problem, because abiogenesis, that is life coming from non-life, you have dead stuff and it becomes living stuff, requires a certain type of biochemical organization. And this is Doug Axe's specialty. A certain type of biochemical organization. Certain things, like proteins, famously. They are long strings of amino acids like pearls on a thing, and then they, because of their nature, they wrap in a certain way and form three-dimensional tertiary structure. And all of this is coded in the order of the amino acids on the chain, on the pearl necklace. And each of these is like a letter. And so each of these letters spell out something important. And some of these are thousands and thousands and thousands of beads long, amino acid long. So now you've got something else. You have language built into the biological realm. And there is no ontology of language. That is, there is no, I'm not sure if I used the right word there, it might be metaphysics, but the point is certainly nothing about the physical world can account for meaning in symbols. All right? And so, I mean, I got a piece of paper here with the article on it, you know, and I remember Stephen Meyer saying this one of my first classes at Talbot when I was getting my MA Phil. And he held up the piece of paper and he said, you could know every single thing about this paper physically to the nth degree, that is omnisciently, but you will never know what it says. Because language and the meaning of the symbols is not embodied in the physical stuff. But we have physical stuff with language, a massive library written on the DNA, a double helix of every living cell, okay? So this is where the metaphysical is coming in. There are certain things that in principle cannot be explained by naturalistic science. You must go outside of it to do that. And this is why an assumption that one of these days we'll get it done is, you know, that's whistling in the dark, if you ask me. And one of these days we'll explain how something came from nothing. Now, like the universe coming out of uncaused, right? And I think all one has to do is reflect on the notion itself to know that this will never happen, because the only way it could happen is by some kind of mechanism. But before the universe existed, on their view, there is no mechanism. So there can't be a cause that doesn't exist. And if there is no cause, there's no effect. That's the metaphysical problem. So again, there is a little bit of a straw man here, like a subtle accusation of a God of the gaps thing. And then there's an imposition of science of the gaps, which presumes metaphysical naturalism. At least in our case, when we posit God with intelligence. We are saying this has the marks of agency on it, so we have a reason for drawing the conclusion that an agent made it. You know, there is no reason that we have to believe that any natural process can produce a language that can be read, a blueprint that makes things. None. And so this is, I think, another weakness in the way that our author here approaches this question.
Okay, so if I can jump in here, Greg, in the very next paragraph, he says, if you come across such an argument, so he's talking about arguments like you just described, okay, mm-hmm. that these Christians who use science, you come across such an argument, he says, you can dispel the smokescreen mm-hmm. by asking if they would drop any part of their faith after science answered their question. Mm-hmm. He says, if the answer is no, responding to their question is a waste of time. Mm-hmm. Now, this actually leads to our third point, because he asks, is there any part if science, whatever that means, answers their question, would they drop any part of their faith? Mm-hmm. And my response is, you do not understand the role science plays in a person's faith, because I can't think of any reason, any explanation from science that would cause me to drop my faith, to leave my faith. And so this is where we looked at our cumulative case. This fails to account for our cumulative case. It fails to account for the role of science that it plays in the Christian's life. And third, it fails to account for what I just called the hierarchy of our beliefs. Mm-hmm. Okay. I said, I'm not sure how science could destroy my faith, since no major doctrine hinges on something established by science. Evolution, abiogenesis, you know, the list goes on of examples, mm-hmm. are all secondary issues.
Or tertiary to the broader question.
Yeah, depending on what
or third level
use for that.
Are you still there?
Yeah. I think I cut out.
Oh, no, that's okay. I was just simply saying, or even third level, when you're thinking the broader questions like God's existence and then the grounding that provides for Christian theology.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So none of these holds the power to refute an essential of Christianity. On the other hand, I said evolution and abiogenesis are essential doctrines on the atheist view.
That's right.
These, as Alvin Plantinga put it, are the only game in town. There are no other options. Mm-hmm. So this author, I think, is confusing what's essential on his worldview and what's essential on our view, on mm-hmm. our worldview. Mm-hmm. If scientists show that abiogenesis and evolution couldn't happen, and that, let's say, intelligent design is the best explanation, then he actually would be forced by the evidence to abandon his naturalism. But if scientists somehow show that abiogenesis and evolution did happen, okay, mm-hmm. then all that happens, in my view, is my interpretation of some verses has to change. Yeah. You know, I maybe have to reinterpret Genesis 1 or something like that. But my worldview pretty much stays intact.
Right, right. We're back to Thor and lightning again. Okay,
that's right.
So
that's
what? Right. So Thor doesn't make lightning. So what? What does that have to do with anything in terms of the foundational worldview? And I think that's the broader point.
I mean, it's an honest question. What, and that's what I want to ask the author here, is what scientific explanation, you know, could come out that would cause a Christian to lose their faith? Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't say, and I think I know why. I think it's because any argument that he states will show how silly his argument is. It would be like if he said something like, well, irreducible complexity, if the scientists just refuted that, mm-hmm. or if they refuted, you know, let's say they refute Stephen Meyer's books, mm-hmm. you know, his Darwin's Signature in the Cell. Okay, fine. But my faith doesn't rest on Stephen Meyer's books, you know. Those to me are icing on the cake. You know, mm-hmm. they support my view, I think, when you start to look into those things. But to think that, oh, my faith is at risk, you know, that's what he mm-hmm. says here. You know, it says that foundation might crumble as science changes, which would put your faith at risk. Mm-hmm. No. My faith is not built on science, and so if some scientific explanation crumbles, my faith doesn't crumble with it.
Yeah, I want to underscore that statement because I think something you said earlier might be misunderstood by some. That's not going to hurt my faith. None of the things in science, even if it's all proved wrong, would hurt my faith. And that might be taken as a fideistic response. That is, I'm going to have faith no matter what the evidence shows. But that's not what you're saying.
No.
You're saying that this category of evidence for Christianity and Christian theism is not essential for the existence, for the legitimacy of Christian theism, and therefore maintaining your confidence in the truth of Christian theism is still entirely legitimate and unaffected, even if the whole so-called scientific or maybe empirical case fails or falters in some way or is thrown into question. That's just one piece of the puzzle. And I'm glad you mentioned Jay Warner's book, the God's Crime Scene, because there he deals with, trying to remember, like I think six broad categories of things, and some of them are scientific. That is the origin of the universe and the fine-tuning of the universe. And the fine-tuning of the universe, and this is something Doug Axe was talking about the other night, is so overwhelming. And he was just simply, actually, in this case, talking about getting a simple amino acid chain, you know, and the chances for that. What he did was he put a pointer, like a laser pointer, on the ceiling at the venue where we were both speaking. He shined it up at the ceiling, and then he gave another pointer to someone else and put a blindfold on, actually just put his mouth mask on his eyes, you know. And then shine, they said, you overlap your red beam being blindfolded with my red beam. You know, it's a big ceiling, right? Well, he never got anywhere close. And he said, but the chance of hitting the beams together are pretty hard here. But I want to tell you what the chances are using that kind of illustration of getting one simple amino acid in the right order. And he said, it's one beam is an electron, and the ceiling is the known universe. So you have to hit one electron, hit another electron in the known universe, okay, to be able to say that these are the, this is the probability that something like just the single amino acid string would be accomplished by chance. So, I mean, these are the kinds of things we're looking at. They're not just improbable. They are impossible. And when you have multitudes of these things that are then arranged in very particular ways to like make living machines, biological machines, I mean, it just beggars the imagination here to deny that there is a creative hand at force here. And for someone to say, well, science will answer that question. Oh, yeah? Really? How even in principle is that going to be possible? So all in all, even so, given the evidence we have, maybe it'll change. It's still fair to go with the evidence we have to draw our conclusions. We go with the best evidence available, the best justified evidence in a whole realm of categories. And this is why I mentioned Jay Warner, because the fine tuning is just, and it's, that's multifaceted itself, is just one of like 12 categories that he has in that book. And it's a whole array of things. And it turns out what's really great is that there is one answer that solves the problem for all 12 of these areas. And that's the existence of God. So if you want to go to Occam's razor and find the simplest solution, I mean, that adequately answers the challenge, there it is. And I added one to him. I said, using his criminal or detective motif, I said, plus you have a signed confession.
Yeah.
Which is the Bible.
Yeah. And that's a second book, right? That's his, yeah,
that's right.
Cold Case Christianity.
Yeah. And by the way, a second book in another way is that we have been talking about the book of nature.
Yeah.
But that's also the book of the Bible.
That's
and
right.
So these are working in concert with each other. Yeah.
I'm glad you clarified that, Greg, because I appreciate scientific evidence. I like science, you know. My point was, look at, there's essentials and there's non-essentials. And for those who say, well, you're just believing, Tim, there's nothing that could refute your faith, that's not true. I'm saying that I can't think of anything from science that would refute my faith. But if mm-hmm. if you could show that God doesn't exist, and so, for example, maybe there's something logically incoherent about the idea of God, well, that would show that there couldn't be a God. And you know what I'm saying? There's a way to refute Christianity. Or
yeah,
how about right. the resurrection? Mm-hmm. If the evidence was stacked up against it, I actually think there's really good evidence for the resurrection. And so on. There's another example of something that could destroy Christian faith. So I'm
That's
not
right. Sure. It is Christianity is falsifiable, but
yes.
not in the way that is suggested in this article. That's another way of putting it.
That's good.
If nothing in science, if all the things that we think God is required to explain, intelligent design, in the empirical world, turn out to be explainable by some naturalistic process. And I've already said that there are some of them that it seems in principle cannot be explained, like language in the DNA double helix or the incredible complexity, irreducible complexity and specified complexity that we see in the biological realm and also in the fine-tuned constants of the universe. And by the way, when Richard Dawkins says, well, we just got lucky, that's not adequate for me, okay? That's a cop-out. That's a way of saying you've got a really good point and the only way that I can win is to claim luck on my side, all right? But now I'm losing my track of the point that I was making, but that happens on occasion. But just to go over real quickly, his points, first of all, we claim that science supports Christianity. We do that, okay? But we want to clarify exactly what we mean. We're not just hitching our wagon to the latest scientific theory. And even if we did, that would be okay. It just has a certain vulnerability, but so does every other discipline that we use to defend our faith. We are actually trying to look at well-documented empirical data. Like, for example, gravity is gravity. Why it works, that requires an explanation, but that it's there doesn't. Nobody doubts that such a thing exists. So those are the kinds of things we're trying to work with. Secondly, that science is a poor foundation for faith. We kind of spoke to that, and I just mentioned it myself. Well, there might be some liabilities, but even if we lose science, it's not the foundation for our faith. It is just one line of evidence in favor of the truth of the Christian worldview. And when scientific evidence turns against us, we refuse to abandon our faith. Well, that's because this is only a piece of the puzzle. It's not the whole thing, as you pointed out, Tim. Science is just one little small piece. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that's a lot more important. And we aren't going to just assume that abiogenesis is going to get explained by a naturalistic process either. His final point, final salvo, and we got about a minute to go here. Wow, that went fast. Is that therefore faith or trust is not really based on evidence for Christians, but it's really blind faith, or maybe based on emotion. And that since all of his premises were misguided in the ways that we've described, I think the conclusion doesn't follow. Evidence matters, and that's why it matters so much in the scripture. And I think you've made a good point about that in your own teaching about science and faith, that when it comes to faith, scripture has a very clear definition of what that involves.
Mm-hmm.
That's your cue to tell us what the definition is.
Definition of faith?
Yes.
This is a definition I got from you. Active trust based on evidence. It's trust. It's a synonym. This is how the Old Testament, the New Testament right. authors use the word.
And the statement based on evidence is what's critical. That's the kind of trust that is knowledgeable trust. It's not, and the scripture is constantly enjoining us. I was trying to throw you a softball there, Tim.
Yeah.
The scripture is constantly enjoining us to look at the evidence, to look at the evidence. Anyway, time's up here, Tim. You can go wash your dishes
Red
Pen Logic or whatever you want.
This was fun. Thanks, Greg.
Yes. Thanks for the help on this one. We work together. All right, friends, that's it for this particular segment. Those on the line, stay on the line. We'll be recording another hour. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. God bless you and give them heaven. Bye.